He thinks he'll keep her, and Mary Chapin Carpenter is with me in the studio today. It's so good to see you, Mary Chapin. It really is.
It's so good to see you, too.
And, you know, we were just reflecting a moment ago, weren't we, about all the changes that have taken place between, well, then and now.
Yes.
And releasing a new album into the sort of current climate of the music industry is a very different experience, I guess, from the way that it was 15 or 20 years ago.
It is completely different. The first thing that comes to my mind is the very first record I put out, I begged the record company to allow it to come out on a cassette. I mean, that tells you it was only on vinyl, the very first record I came out with it. And then the next record, it came out on cassette, and so that felt like progress. And then I think it was about two records after that, and so maybe 7 or 8 years into my career with Sony, it came out on a CD, and that was a very big deal.
Yes, but this particular recording for you, Mary Chapin, this is a particularly personal recording as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, it reflects back on a moment in your life which was extremely testing.
Yes. It was about 3 years ago, and I got sick. I had a blood clot that resulted in what is known as a pulmonary embolism. And I was very fortunate and had great care. But it's taken me a long time to get back to work. And it's been a wonderful experience to put out this record and sort of return to what I used to do. You sort of lose your identity, I think, when something like that stops you in your tracks and you lose your purpose and you don't really know what you're doing. And I certainly went through that.
And I guess then in that respect also, the writing of the songs for this album is a happy, sad experience.
And it always is.
Yeah. Could you play something for us from the new album, Mary Chapin? What would you like to play?
I'd like to play this song. It's called I Have a Need for Solitude. And I spent the summer introducing it to audiences by saying that it has a few aspects to it. It's a love song to my home, first and foremost. I live in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia, and I live on a farm. It's a beautiful place, and I have a lot of pets. I have 6 dogs and 5 cats, and we all like to hang out together and take walks, and it's a beautiful place. And more specifically, it's an homage to the time of day that I grew up having this term in my head, that period of time between dusk and darkness. I don't know who first told me this, but they call it the magic time. And on the farm, it's definitely that. And so it's about that time of day and what it's like to be there and kind of what I seek in my life. So it's called I Have a Need for Solitude.
I have a need. Solitude, I'll never be safe in crowded rooms. I like the sound of silence coming on. I come around when everyone has gone on. I have a need. Cool, verdant spaces beneath the trees. Secret empty places nobody knows. So no one will intrude. I have a need for solitude. But you can find me when the light is changing at that time of day when there's little day remaining. You can find me where I've been waiting, waiting here for you. I never was the pretty girl in school. I never fast, tough, and cool. All I was All my life it seems was hard to love, harder now to keep, but you can find me when the light is changing at that time of day when there's little day remaining. Solitude, I'll never be safe in crowded rooms. I like the sound of silence coming on. I come around when all the rest have gone.
Chapin Carpenter, who is with us today on Bob Harris Country. The song is from the new album, The Age of Miracles, recorded here in Nashville.
Yes.
And with what a team, what a wonderful team. I was just jotting down the names. So obviously Matt Rollins, yes, keyboardist, but also co-producer.
Yes.
Russ Kunkel, the great Russ Kunkel, Glenn Wolf on bass, Duke Levine on guitars, but also great contributors too. You know, Vince Gill.
Yes.
Alison Krauss.
Mac McNally.
Yes.
Just, wonderful singers all.
Yes. So how did you, as it were, gather this team around you for the recording of this album then?
Well, Matt and I have worked together for the last two records, and really we just kind of sit down beforehand and have a wish list. And we knew that we wanted it to be just a full band, full on, straight ahead, you know, we're all playing together. Not a lot of overdubs, you know. So it was just core group, and we just went for it.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful, very fruitful time. I think of those sessions with such affection. Just, it was a wonderful time.
Early days and Washington as a sort of starter point. I get the feeling that that was a very good place in a way for you to have sort of eventually landed, because I mean, you spent time abroad and everything, but mm-hmm. what was it, 74, I think. Mm-hmm. Did you find when you got there that there was a kind of sympathetic musical environment as you began to sort of develop your craft?
Well, I think when I discovered the music scene in Washington at that time when we moved there, I mean, Washington was known as the bluegrass capital of the world at that time. I don't think a lot of people realize that, but it was true. It was a real hotbed of bluegrass music and, by extension, acoustic, you know, music and old time and singer-songwriters. And I had never really listened to much bluegrass, and I became just a huge fan. And sort of through that, I think, discovered acoustic singer-songwriters in that world that is so rich and many layers deep. Because I had grown up listening to, you know, pop bands and Motown music, and, you know, the singer-songwriters that I suppose that I loved and knew about were people like Randy Newman. And I don't think I really knew what else was out there until I moved to Washington.
So then one of the sort of real kind of direction-pointing moments would have been, I guess, your meeting with John Jennings.
Oh, sure.
Was that a kind of one of the turning point moments?
I think so, because he encouraged me to play my own music. And up to that time, I mean, I loved to write and I had songs, but I just didn't think of them as, oh, I don't know, I just maybe didn't have the confidence. And while I had a certain number of very dear friends who were sort of doing the same thing I was and going to open mics and playing little shows here and there, little gigs, you know, and you'd sort of sneak one of your songs in your set that was primarily other people's music. You know, I would do that, but John was very encouraging about doing more of that. And so to have someone that you respect tell you that and sort of encourage you, I think that is a moment in your life where you realize it's sort of before and after.
Yeah, because we were talking a moment ago, weren't we, about the way things change, but some things never change, do they? And I was talking this week in Nashville with a young artist called Joe Pug, who's really making a mark. He's one of the Horizon sort of award-nominated artists at the Americanas this week. And, you know, the way that you started, having made a demo, having made a recording of the demo, then really merch desk at the back of the gig kind of things.
Yeah, in your back pocket. Yeah,
absolutely. But then that leading you to getting noticed and recognized and then eventually into a, as it were, a bigger contract, which was kind of the process, wasn't it, across 2 or 3 years in the way that it happened for you in the mid-80s?
Well, it was completely accidental. I mean, I really don't think I... Maybe it was a defensive posture, but I really never allowed myself to think that I could make a living playing music. I mean, I was sort of scratching out a living and, like I said, playing in bars and clubs, and but I had my day job that I was doing, and I was biding my time, I suppose, until life figured itself out. But I really didn't think that I was purposefully going towards music. It was just that's what I was doing to pay my rent at the time. So when this person heard it and passed it on to that person, it's like these sort of happy accidents that occurred despite my, well, you know, non-effort towards it. So it's just, it, to me, I can sit here across from you right now and just genuinely say it still is a shocker to me that this happened.
So then Hometown Girl was released in 87, State of the Heart in 1989. And I'd like to play, if I may, a track from State of the Heart. Never Had It So Good.
This is a really ancient history.
You grimace as I...
I mean, I just haven't heard these in a long time, and I don't think I'm different from anyone in my position who would probably listen to something like that after many, many years and go, oh my God, you know, how young was I? It's probably like a little squeaky high voice singing the song, a little helium balloon or something, I don't know.
We shall hear it.
No.
Never Had It So Good, Mary Chapin Carpenter from the State of the Heart album from 1989. So has it really been a long time since you heard that?
I think it's been since 1989 since I heard that song. All I could think of was the boyfriend that I wrote it with. Guy. I think there was that song, and then there was a, one or two other songs on that record that I called the Ex-Boyfriend Trilogy. You know, just, oh my God.
But that's the great thing. In, here in Nashville, they've got that. I always try and paraphrase it. I never get it quite right. But you meet someone, you fall in love. You know, you break up and you leave. Either way, you've got a song.
Right, exactly. And one of my friends, I remember when she heard the record, she said, well, you know, yeah, he broke your heart, but you got a lot of good songs out of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But in terms of then, you know, finding yourself in that situation, I mean, it's funny, actually, because I was watching your reaction as we were listening to that. Your reaction kind of mirrored mine when I see myself 35 years ago on television doing the old grey whistle test, where I recognized, you know, I didn't really kind of know what I was doing.
That's how I feel when I listen to that.
I hadn't learned any craft of it. Yeah. I just sort of closed my eyes and jumped in.
It's like a child that you love, you know, and you don't want to disparage that child in any way. But it is from this place to listen to that. It seems very innocent, and I just sort of see this huge sort of world spread out in front of me and see all the places that that person hadn't yet discovered.
Yes, exactly. But then the next album and then the album after that, and suddenly you're catapulted into a level which I bet you never expected.
Never.
When you first started out.
Never.
So getting your brain around all that then with the release of the Come On, Come On album and all the awards and the hit singles and everything else, how did you go about sort of adjusting to this new thing that had happened to you?
You know, I don't have a pithy answer for that. I think of it as a process of trial and error, really. But I always was very fortunate to have very sensible people around me and sort of supporting me. And I think without that level of attention and sort of white hot fame and celebrity and that sort of thing that comes along with it can be very perilous for people. I mean, we see examples of that every day. So, you know, I just had a lot of people who were always on my side and willing to step in if they thought I was making a mistake or, you know.
I'd like to play a track at this moment from Come On, Come On. And the one that we thought would be Passionate Kisses. Oh. Again, has it been a while since you heard this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it now.
Okay.
Mary Chapin Carpenter, that's Passionate Kisses from the album Come On, Come On. Two reasons for playing that, really. First of all, because that was the first song. I mean, there are other big hits from that album, but that was the one that really took you across into mainstream, wasn't it? Into the sort of pop and adult contemporary charts.
Yes.
And so, but also, of course, it's a Lucinda Williams
Yes.
song. So I'm curious as to how you would have come across that song, where you first heard it, and what decided you to record that.
Well, I was a great fan of Lucinda's. She had a couple of records out, that first Rough Trade record that was just so fabulous, that had this song on it and a number of others. I just loved her music. And then I got to tour with her and Roseanne Cash. We went to Australia together and just played our songs in the round at night, and she knew that I loved the song because every night I would just slobber all over her and tell her how much I loved her music. And one night she just said, oh, for goodness sake, just record the darn song. And I said, okay. And I felt like I got her blessing. And again, listening to it, it's like a lot of different things go through my mind. I remember turning that record in, and Sony didn't hear it. You know, eventually they heard it, and that was wonderful. But at first, when I turned the record in, they said, we don't hear any singles on this album. And I said, you don't hear He Thinks He'll Keep, you don't hear Passionate Kiss. They go, no, mm-mm. And what seemed to change things was that we went out on tour, and we opened for a number of different bands, and we would play Passionate Kisses, and the audience response was really great. And so the record representatives who were seeing us on those shows would go back to Sony and say, this song is getting a lot of response in the audience. You need to rethink your thinking about this. And that seemed to turn things around.
And there are a few endorsements, aren't there? More kind of, as it were, profound than having a song of yours covered by Joan Baez.
Oh.
Because, I mean, she's a supreme artist, isn't she? And, you know, she has a reputation, and has had a reputation right through the years, mm-hmm. of, as it were, hand-picking really excellent songs, and in that way, also in her own way, shining the spotlight on artists that she believes in.
Yes.
And, of course, she recorded Stones in the Road.
I'll never forget how that came about. I was out in her house in California. We were rehearsing for a concert with Joan, myself, and the Indigo Girls. And so we were sitting around her kitchen table, and she was saying, all right, gals, what are we all going to play tomorrow night? Because we knew we were doing a bunch of songs together, and then we were going to have a few moments where we'd each step out and do a solo number. And I had finished writing Stones in the Road, so I thought, well, maybe I'll just try that out. And she had told me, just as we had met that day, that she was looking for songs. She wanted to make a record. For the first time in her life, she wanted to make a record of songs that hadn't been, they weren't covers. They were original versions. So it was really important that she find the right songs. Mm-hmm. So I remember sitting at her kitchen table, and I played this song, and I noticed as I was finishing the song, I hadn't quite finished it, she was writing something on a piece of paper. And I finished the song, and she slid the piece of paper at me, and it said, I have to have this song. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, this is unbelievable. And then, you know, fast forward a few months, and she called me when I was in Australia, and she said, I really want to do that song, but I had told her that I had intended to record it myself for my next record. And I said, you can have it. I'll cut it for the next record, but that's not for 6 months, and I'm so thrilled and honored that you connect to it in some way. I can still cut it. It's not, it didn't mean anything to me that I didn't have the first version.
Yeah.
It meant so much to me that she wanted to sing it.
Will you play it for us now?
I'd love to.
Okay.
Sure.
We were young, we pledged allegiance every morning of our lives. The classroom rang with children's voices under teachers' watchful eyes. Learned about the world around us at our desks and at dinner time. Reminded of the starving children, we cleaned our plates with guilty minds. stones in the road, they shone like diamonds in the dust, until a voice called to us to make our way back home. When I was 10, my father held me on his shoulders above the crowd to see a train draped in mourning pass slowly through our town. His widow kneeled with all their children at the sacred burial ground, and the TV glowed that long hot sun with all the cities burned down. And the stones in the road flew out beneath our bicycle tires, worlds removed from all those fires, as we raced each other home. And now we drink our coffee on the run, we climb that ladder We are the daughters and the sons, but here's the line that's missing. The starving children have been replaced by souls out on the street. We give a dollar when we pass, hope our eyes don't meet. We pencil in, we cancel out, we crave the corner suite. Kiss your ass, we make you whole, we doctor the receipt. And the stones in the road, they fly out from beneath our wheels. Another day, another deal, before we get back home. Stones in the road, leave a mark whence they came. Thousand points of light or shame, babe, I don't know.
Stones in the Road. 1994 it was when that album came out. And you know, it's interesting around that moment in time, Mary Chapin, because I sort of think of that moment as being covers and collaboration moment. You know, the co-writes, the number of songs of yours that were getting covered. Wynonna Judd did Girls with Guitars, of course. You're also working with Sean Colvin.
Yeah.
Of course. You were singing with Rodney Foster. The Nobody Wins, and of course with Joan Baez on the live recording of Diamonds and Rust. Mm. So, I mean, there's kind of a lot going on at this moment,
yeah,
isn't there?
You're reminding me now. You know, you forget about things. Those are good memories.
Yeah. A busy time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that, in a way, now there's an aspect of full circle about the fact that you're going to be touring in Britain with Tift Merritt.
Uh-huh.
Because I know that you're a big fan of
Tiff's.
I am too.
Yes.
I really, really love her music. So yes. In a way, you know, you are Joan Baez.
Oh, no. That'll never be the case. No.
But acknowledging, you know, a young artist that's coming through in the way that Tift has been establishing herself over recent years.
She's just wonderful. She's just such a wonderful and beautiful songwriter and a beautiful spirit.
She is. So then, Place in the World, 1996.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the collection, the Party Doll and Other Favorites, which came out in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
But really then, between Place in the World and Time, Sex, Love, there's a gap of 5 years there. What was the reason for that gap suddenly opening up?
Well, I do remember the genesis of Party Doll. Sony wanted me to put out a greatest hits record, and I always felt so allergic to the idea of greatest hits records when you didn't have a body of work to support it. And I felt that it was premature. I felt like it was sort of self-aggrandizing in a way. If I was going to have to do it, I wanted it to be something that wasn't just dumping a bunch of old tracks on a record and then one new song on the end to justify it in a way. I remember a lot of that time I spent digging through recorded versions, different versions, finding songs that were slightly different from the recorded versions so that it could be a project with some sort of artistic merit to me than more than just a typical greatest hits record. Mm. So I was sort of involved doing that, but also I was touring all the time. That was, again, when we started out talking today about how things are different. I remember you could tour without a new record out. That's different. Mm. That's very old school. And nowadays, it's so economically challenging to tour that you really do need a new record to sort of propel you out there, I think. So I was enjoying myself just touring and having a life and putting this so-called greatest hits record together and writing at the same time. But I was always feeling, again, resistant to the idea that there had to be a schedule of putting records out. I had a good enough relationship with my record company that they were supportive of that. Mm. And I've always been grateful for that.
And were the topics now beginning to change slightly? You know, the Party Dolls collection and then the Time, Sex, Love album. Mm-hmm. And you look at the body of songs represented on each. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that now, that you're beginning to kind of, I don't know, just find a slightly different place?
Well, you know, I just didn't want to be ruled, or you just want to follow your muse. And at the time, also, my record label was finding it a challenge to put me out there. And the facts of the matter is that they need you to try to get on the radio. And I thought that I was providing them songs to do that, but everyone's perception changes and everybody's notion of who you are changes, and that changes what they hear from you. And from my perspective, I hadn't changed, but you know, time moves on.
Yeah.
And the idea that they're looking for something different from you can be at odds of what you think of yourself.
Yeah.
And so I remember turning in Time, Sex, Love, and here's an example of the things that were just kind of sources of conflict. I think the very first song on that record had an electric sitar on it. And the research came back saying, country radio doesn't like the sound of that electric sitar. I loved it. I thought, here we are, Bollywood. You know? And I was very resistant to wanting to take that off. And I just felt that it was pragmatic enough to make sense, but artistically, it just didn't feel right to me.
No.
So we were starting to be at odds with each other about things like that. And, you know, I think the one thing that I was always very proud of in my relationship with Sony was that we, you know, I think of it as a marriage, and you find your compromises where you can.
Yeah.
But it was becoming harder and harder to do that, you know, and still make the kind of records I wanted to make.
I want to play another piece of music, and we're just going to sort of jump on a couple of years to 2007 and The Calling and the song Houston. Just tell us about this song, Mary Chapin, and talk us into the track, if you would.
This is a song about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. I imagine the entire world was fixated by those images of the poor residents of New Orleans stranded, ignored, under threat of physical harm, violence, dehydration. I don't have words strong enough to condemn the lack of response to this catastrophe. I could be very straightforward and say the complete and utter failure of George Bush's administration is just, there are no words for it. And that city is still struggling to get on its feet. Fully half of the population have never returned. Mm. But in the weeks after the hurricane, I couldn't tear myself away from the television. And I just was very affected by what I saw. And so this is a song that comes out of those images. I mean, I see them to this day. The very first verse is about seeing a woman pushing her children in a grocery cart looking for her husband. I mean, there were so many images just like that. So it's called Houston.
From the album The Calling from 2007, Mary Chapin Carpenter. The song is called Houston. And, I mean, it's one of a whole number of songs that I could have played to demonstrate your response to the things that go on around you in the world. I mean, even on the same album, On With The Song, or previously from 2004, Grand Central Station, because you were very close to the, I mean, literally, what, a block or two away from the Twin Towers?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And of course, this view that you have and the way that you express your feelings have now been acknowledged through the Spirit of Americana Free Speech in Music Award, of course. And I'm going to quote the sort of definition of the award, because I do think it's important. It recognizes artists who've used their work to raise awareness and promote free speech through their music and other efforts. Mm. And I was particularly delighted that you received this award, Mary Chapin. And again, it puts you in amazing company, doesn't it? Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, Joan Baez, Mavis Staples, Judy Collins, Charlie Daniels, and Steve Earle, a previous recipients. And you received this in Washington, I think, didn't you? Yeah. So again, actually receiving the award in Washington, was that particularly kind of poignant?
It was deeply meaningful to me. My family was able to be there. That meant a great deal. The ceremony was the day that this new record came out. So there was a lot of wonderful things that sort of were there. I was just so deeply honored. I never imagined anything like that would come my way.
Mm. So. Well, it's wonderful. And of course, we're on the eve, aren't we, at the moment now, of your tour of the UK.
Yes.
And we mentioned Tift. Tift is going to be supporting you.
Yes.
The tour begins in Belfast, October the 24th, at the Grand Opera House. And then you go from there to Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdare, Bristol, the Colston Hall, the Barbican Centre in London, and then into November at the Buxton Opera House, which is a beautiful, ornate venue. Yeah. Derby Assembly Hall on the 2nd, Birmingham Town Hall on the 3rd, and the Gateshead Sage on November the 4th. And I also believe you're going to be doing a Terry Wogan show.
I hear that's true.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Well, good luck with all of it.
Thank you.
And then as we move into 2011 then, what are your sort of plans as you look further ahead?
Well, I've had such a wonderful summer getting back on the road. The tour in the UK is just an extension of that, and hopefully a return to coming back far more often. I mean, it's been nearly 10 years since we've been there, and I hope it becomes something we do far more often than we've been able to. And just, you know, returning to sort of that part of my life means everything to me. Mm. That sense of connection and purpose that comes with playing music for people has been missing, and I have missed it terribly.
Yes.
So.
And you're writing outside of music writing. You know, the column in the Washington Times.
Yes.
But that...
That was
you
interesting.
You haven't done that for a while. Would you plan to return to that kind of writing?
Well, I had to stop doing that because it took... Oh, well, I'm such a perfectionist that it took so much time, even though it was like every 2 weeks, this column. And it wasn't that many words. I just took too
it's
much
a
time
discipline, isn't it?
To
yeah,
real discipline.
Yeah.
I have so much respect for people who write on deadline.
Yeah.
I had never experienced that before, really. So I had to finally say, you know what, I can't do this anymore because it's getting in the way of songwriting. So I don't know if I can take on another commitment quite like that if I'm trying to write a record at the same time. But I liked doing it, and I liked the different muscle, I guess, that you have to sort of engage to write something other than songs.
Yes.
You know, I found
well,
that...
Well, it's a sort of different discipline as well,
it's very
it?
Different,
yeah.
And I really enjoyed learning the things I learned about myself as a writer.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to close with actually the closing track from The Age of Miracles.
That would be great.
So again, will you just talk us into this track and tell us about the song?
Well, you know, again, we started out talking about the idea that an album is hopefully a journey of sorts. And I mean, you know, when you sequence a record, I mean, to me, that's a tremendously important aspect of it because you really want to set up the journey, right? So this is the last song on the record. And what was important to me was that while this album as a whole had, you know, sort of addressed the harder things as well as the sort of things that you discover about yourself through adversity, in the end, I felt like it was important that the last song you hear is a song of strength, resilience, belief in oneself, and the freedom that comes with that. And specifically, this is a song about that rite of passage that I think we all, I hope we all experience in our lives when we find a night waiting for us, a night being the dark of night, rather. We get in the car, we just take off, we have the radio on, we have the windows rolled down, we may be singing along to the radio, we may not, but we are free, we are anonymous, we are just going. And the sense of liberation and joy and self-acceptance that comes with that.